Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 2nd of April, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, hello, sir. How you doing? How you doing, man?
Good evening. Well, as could be expected. Nothing to rave about, to be honest.
Hanging in there. Of course, you're still recovering from your illness. So we're just glad that we're able to get you on the show once a week. You must be pretty tired out during the rest of the week, I would guess.
Yeah, save me strength for this one.
Good man. It's good to be talking to you again. And I'm sure the listeners appreciate the effort you put in to being here.
As I do them, yeah.
Yeah, we certainly do appreciate our listeners, and if listeners want to get hold of your work, they can find that at moneytreepublishing.com, where you can purchase Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. You can purchase the DVD set from there, and a portion of the money from that goes to Dennis here. Dennis, how are the sales doing? Is it doing well there, the DVD?
Yeah, I haven't heard how the Communism by the Back Door is doing. I believe that's going to sell, but certainly, The Greatest Story Never Told is and probably always will be the more popular one.
It stands as test of time, doesn't it? It's not going to go out of fashion, is it? Really?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. No.
And it's so well made. It doesn't really sort of rely on any time. I mean, it could have been made at any point in the last 20 years, and you'd still be wanting to watch it. And you know, I mean, with the high definition that you have nowadays, what you're looking at in that film there is film from the 30s and the 40s. Mm. So the fact that it's not high definition, Blu-ray, all fancy and the rest of it, you're never going to get a film from that time that's going to be like
exactly.
That. So it's timeless, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
It's a great documentary. So you say Communism by the Back Door may be up yet. Do you know if it's...
Yeah, I don't know 100%, but I was told it was going to be, so I'm presuming it is. And that itself, I knew at the time, would probably come into its own at a later date, which probably what's gone on in America in, you know, the past year with the Trump election, etc., and what was going on in the cities, Berlin and Antifa, that probably has a lot of, to do with today, and it shows how it was all planned.
I think also you were sort of preempting the degeneracy with the transsexualism when you were talking about Hollywood and the pedophiles and how degenerate all of that was. And this was before they were really pushing this onto the children with the drag kids and all the transsexual stuff that we see with kids now. You were sort of talking about that back then. Before
it grew from the United Nations, though.
Yeah, before it had really become a big thing. Well, we'll get an advert up for that once we can get a link for it. We'll put that on the site, get people checking that out again. And so I guess because you're still recovering, you haven't really been working on Churchill's body count or anything else then,
No,
Dennis?
I have been looking at the software. If you remember, I was telling you about software being updated, and so I've got to get used to using it again. And I have been toying with it, but only in a minor way, nothing major.
Well, one thing you might look at doing is signing up at Odyssey and uploading your videos there, because BitChute, they seem to be facing a lot of problems from Hope Not Hate and from the British government, and they're being overly careful with videos, and anything that is to do with World War II, it seems, they're banning so that people can't watch it in Europe. And some of your videos may well be banned from being watched in Britain, even though they're perfectly legal. BitChute may be shielding them from people, and you may want to put them on Odyssey, which seems to be much better quality platform as well. And it can't be taken down from there because it's on the blockchain. It can't be censored from there.
So, okay.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to it. I definitely think you should get on there. Everyone's moving over to Odyssey now, and they've just started live streaming as well the last couple of days. So They may
where they're based, you know?
Somewhere in America.
Right.
Somewhere in America. It's very professional, and they've got their own cryptocurrency. And that's how they're trying to go after them in America. The authorities are saying, well, these cryptocurrencies, they have to be regulated like securities. And Odyssey, which is run by LBRY, they're saying that's the biggest one of these new cryptocurrencies, and they're trying to go after them. So there's a court thing to do with that, but it can't really be censored because it's on the blockchain. All they could do is remove things from the Google rankings, but that would be just about it, because once it's there, it's there, and only the producer can take it down. As I say, it looks very professional. End up taking YouTube on. I think it's definitely going to surpass BitChute because it already has live streaming, and all different types of content is on there as well. It's not just alternative content. It's all sorts. So a little plug there for Odyssey. Right, well, this week we're going to be getting into the third part of our little mini-series here on Jewish emigration in the Third Reich, based around Ingrid Weckert's book of the same name. We'll just begin by stating what it was she was hoping to achieve with this, and we're hoping to achieve this as well here at Truthful Out Radio. She says, emigration was not some kind of wild flight, leaving all your money and possessions behind, but rather a lawfully determined and regulated matter. The purpose of this work is to elucidate the emigration process in law and policy, thereby augmenting the traditionally received picture of Jewish emigration from Germany during the Third Reich. So we're just expanding on history here, which is really the point of this podcast, is to look at the alternative versions of history and discuss them and look at the patterns that we observe going on in history and talk about the sides of history that you're not going to find on the mainstream. That really seems to be our purpose here, Dennis. Would you agree with that?
I would, 100%, yeah.
And also a Christian view of it as well.
Yeah, well, I was going to say about the New World Order DVD, Communism by the Back Door. Communism is everything, including, you know, Satanism and everything else, what goes to destroy Christianity. And that's exactly what communism is. It uses different forms to attack Christianity. And that's what you find in that DVD. And what we've found in history, what's being changed quite rapidly, I believe.
Well, you could say that was the one consistency through the communism of the past and the communism of today is the hatred of God and the atheism.
Completely.
You know, they may not have been transsexualism in the communism of the past. Communism of the past may have been fairly patriotic in some instances, but one thing it never was is supportive of Christianity. Always been against that. That was the number one enemy of communism. Well, let's have a recap of what we discussed last week. We heard how the Zionists wanted their own country, their own homeland for Jews only, and the National Socialists were their natural allies, as the National Socialists also wanted to have a homeland all to themselves. There were three agencies for Jewish emigration, one to Palestine, one to elsewhere in the world, and one for Jews that were just passing through Germany. There were also two agreements made for the emigration of Jews, one that would take them anywhere, and one that was specifically for taking Jews to Palestine. And we concentrated on the Agency for Emigration to Palestine and the Havarah Agreement that it made with the NS administration. They wanted young Jews who could work, and they wanted rich Jews who could pay for the work. And lots of legal means were created for Jews to get their money out of Germany and into Palestine, as there was a foreign currency embargo on Germany as part of a, quote, world Jewry's war on Germany. And it was world Jewry that declared war on Germany. That was their terminology. War, Judea declares war on Germany was their
holy war.
They definitely called it that as well. That was the particular one in America, wasn't it, at a stadium?
That's right, yeah. Well, it went over the radio, didn't it, as well? We covered it in the last series we did when I can't remember his name now, but he complained about the bankers sending money to Germany, if you remember.
Yeah, I do. And I can't remember the exact name of the banker as well. It wouldn't have been Max Warburg, would it?
No, but it wasn't the guy I was thinking of. But Warburg was involved, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was one of the others that was complaining about them all paying back, all paying money to Germany in loans, and then Hitler using it for nationalist purposes. And he was telling them off. Telling them all off for helping the Germans out. German Jews could even travel to Palestine for a sightseeing trip first, while all other German citizens were banned from leaving the country. Jews were even exempt from paying the travel tax that others had to pay if they wanted to emigrate, and loans were created that Jews did not have to pay back for years, just so that they could afford to emigrate. The modernisation that occurred due to this influx of wealth and skills led to Palestine leaving the pre-industrial age and becoming a centre for art, science and medicine. Jewish authors today are not pleased to hear that the Zionists were working with the National Socialists, which is bizarre since those Jews that made it to Palestine were safe once war had broken out in Europe. The Palestinian traders themselves were also not happy that German goods were coming in, as that meant that British and Palestinian goods were not being bought. And that brings us to the end of the recap. I just want to say, but through looking at this and sort of learning about the beginning of Israel, the country itself, and building a homeland, you know, it does. I do have a certain amount of respect for what they actually did there for building a country. This colonizing purpose. It's a noble purpose to create a homeland for your people, and it really would have been the very best of the Jews that went out there to do that. The really hard working ones, and that they completely changed everything around. If you think these Jews have been used to working in journalism, plays, banking, and what they were needed to do when they were out there in Palestine was hard work and building work and farming work, and they had to learn new trades, and it was hard work that they did, and you have to give credit to them for that. That's my thoughts about this recap. Dennis, have you got any thoughts on the recap?
Well, I mean, I can agree with what you're saying there. It's just when they've expanded as they've said they would do in the past, and taken over areas and occupied lands. That's the problem with them. The supporting of ISIS and one or two other factions, which I can't agree with.
Well, that's all many, many years into the future, 70, 80 years into the future, and that is the main criticism of Israel, is that it does keep expanding. But you know, we have to be careful with our criticism, because we did the same in America, we did the same in New Zealand, we did the same in Australia, and it's just that we did all of that hundreds of years ago, and the Jews are now doing it in the modern age after lots and lots of propaganda against us doing it. So when we see them doing it, we think, well, this is very hypocritical of you to be doing this. It's a strange one. It is a strange one.
Yeah, I agree. I did bring up the fact in a bit of story that they got criticised for it, because obviously they were making Hitler and, you know, the National Socialists out to be racist, and that pointed out the fact that I think it was the year that Hitler was born was the last massacre of the Red Indians by the American Army, and also named a couple of other things, like, you know, they were hanging Negroes from trees, and nothing like that was going on in Germany, but yet Hitler was carrying the camp for the racist.
Oh, you certainly saw the races as being different, but they weren't really persecuting people for being a different race. If you were a communist and if you were against the National Socialist State, then you were declared as an enemy, and that was the problem. World Jewry had declared itself as an enemy without any thought for the Jews that happened to reside within Germany. Who were they?
Yeah, it's just about hitting the nail on the head.
This was the problem. Well, moving into the new content here, there was, as well as there being opposition to this Havarah Agreement in Palestine, there was opposition on the German side as well. The Havarah Agreement was also not universally welcomed by Germans. It was, of course, quite a burden on the German foreign exchange market, and there were also political disadvantages. the German Consul General in Jerusalem, Hans Dohle, emphasised in a March 22, 1937 study that through the Havarah Agreement, the German government had subordinated all considerations that are decisive in advancing German interests in other countries to the facilitation of Jewish emigration from Germany and the settlement of immigrant Jews in Palestine. The strengthening of the Jewish economy that we made possible through facilitating the transplanting of German Jewish industrial firms to Palestine necessarily worked against Germany on the world market. Dohle stressed that the opposition of the Palestinian Jews to Germanism is manifested at every opportunity. So he's getting a little bit upset here. The Germans are doing all this work to help this emigration process, doing so much work that they're actually not doing work in other areas that they should do. They've subordinated all their interests to helping Jews move to Palestine, and yet actually in Palestine itself, the Palestinian Jews are very opposed to Germany. And they would have effigies of Hitler and all sorts of things. They would they had a Purim festival there where they were attacking Germany, and the Germans are saying, well, this is not on. We're the ones that are really helping them out here. We're helping them to get to Palestine. We've moved all our manufacturing there for them. We've set these factories up so that they can come out of the pre-industrial age and come into the industrial age, and we're getting no thanks for this at all. So you can understand that the Germans weren't too pleased about what was going on there. You got any thoughts on that, yeah, Dennis?
Well, it's like they're never going to reveal it at that particular time, because they didn't reveal it, or at least one author didn't reveal it till the mid-1980s. So, you know, they're never going to get any thanks.
Well, you won't find any mention of Germany in Palestine when you look up this information on the internet. I've spent quite some time trying to find any mention of German firms or the emigration that Germany was responsible for from sort of between 1930 and 1945. And in Israel and in Palestine, I've looked at the Arab War, the Arab uprising. You know, I've been learning a lot about the beginning of Israel, basically, and there's no mention of Germany's hand in it. There's no mention of the emigration, no mention of these German businesses, nothing at all. It's all about Arab uprisings and Britain. And there's a mysterious gap as well. When the war is on, you really can't find anything out at all about what went on in Palestine during the years of the war. And you think, well, were these Jews on the side of Britain, or were they on the side of the Germans? Because the British had said, you can only bring in a certain amount of Jews to Palestine. I think they said you can bring in 15,000 Jews a year, and that was it. And the Jews were not happy at that. They wanted to bring in as many as they possibly could. So this was the source of the tension between the Palestinian Jews and Britain, and this is why these terrorist organisations were actually attacking British troops after the war, because Britain would not allow them to bring in more Jews that they wanted, whereas Germany wanted to export as many Jews as possible. So you can see why the Germans would be, look, you Palestinian Jews should be supporting Germany.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because, you know, they want to make out Germany as the evil bad guys, and so, you know, it's an agenda to keep it that way, I believe.
Well, it is. There's a lot of hidden history there, I think. A lot of hidden history that somebody really should write a book about, I think. Well, Great Britain felt itself disadvantaged in its Palestinian mandate by the import of German goods and began to attack Germany in its press. According to Dohle's study, the negative balance of the Havarah Agreement was as follows. This is moving back to the German attitude to this. Number one, through export of goods with no foreign currency inflow. Number two, building up the Jewish economy builds anti-German Jewish influence in Palestine. Number three, direction of German imports to Palestine through the Jewish agency without any regard for German mercantile interests. Number four, anger among the local Arab and German businessmen who can only trade with Germany through the Jewish agency. Number 5, anger of the British Mandatory Administration threatened by the German competition. And again, there's no mention of this in the official history, that the British were really upset at what was going on here. The British were not happy about how all these German goods were coming in rather than British goods coming in and the Palestinian Jews paying for British goods. But there's no mention of it. It's weird.
No, it's, well, again, there's an agenda to keep things as they are.
Completely. If one recalls that Durley witnessed anti-German incidents and was aware how much the country owed to German immigrants, his sceptical assessment was not unjustified. Palestine was like the animal that is biting the hand that feeds it. The hostility of the Jews towards Germany expressed itself on many different levels. For example, during a Purim procession, Germany was depicted as a poisonous green fire-breathing dragon covered with swastikas, and a placard demanded Tozeret Haaretz, protection and a boycott of German goods. I mean, how bizarre is that? Boycotting the German goods when the German goods are going through the Jewish agency and are funding the emigration of the Jews into Palestine.
Yeah. And what people forget, though, is that the same demonization came after World War One, when they said they were crucifying Canadians and killing Belgian babies, all investigated after the war and proven to be myths. But, you know, the Second World War was slightly different, but investigations weren't allowed and the demonization has since stuck.
You're talking about the atrocity propaganda there.
That's right.
In the First World War. Well, in spite of it all, Adolf Hitler decided repeatedly that emigration of Jews was to be supported with all means and that a suspension of the Havarah Agreement was out of the question. The transfer of assets through the Havarah remained possible even after the war had begun through neutral countries. These connections broke down only after December 1941, following America's entry into the war. Winding up the Havarah in Germany was entrusted to two Jewish banks, Warburg in Hamburg and Wassermann in Berlin. At the end of the war, there was still Havarah money in the accounts, which had been frozen by the German government as enemy funds. And after 1945, the monies were paid out in full to the owners. So again, that gives you a completely different narrative, doesn't it? This money was frozen, and then it was handed back to the Jews, and it was money which the Jews had put in there for them to take with them once they went to Palestine. And it's not like the Germans were trying to prevent the Jews from getting out. They wanted to keep helping them to move to Palestine, as many of them as possible. And it was the British that were saying that you can only have this amount. And I think they were actually helping the Jews to get out illegally as well, as we'll see, as we'll see later on.
Oh, by the way, it's come to mind that the guy was named, it was Untermeyer, who declared the war on radio.
Yeah, Harold Untermeyer. Well, besides the Reich Economic Ministry, it was paradoxically the SS and its agencies that supported and encouraged the emigration of the Jews. The SS took it upon itself to influence German Jewish policy right from the very beginning. It suggested mass emigration, but warned against putting pressure on those Jews who felt German first and then Jewish. In those Jews, it was necessary first to awaken a Jewish consciousness and a Jewish self-image. This was to take place through Jewish cultural organizations. Only a Jew who had become conscious of his identity would be prepared to leave Germany and to immigrate to a future Jewish homeland. So they wanted to help the Jews to understand their ethnicity and to be proud of their ethnicity. And I noticed as I was looking through the Nuremberg laws today, it was saying about how Germans can fly the German flag, German colours. Jews aren't supposed to do that, but nobody is to stop a Jew from flying the Jewish flag and wearing the Jewish colours. And I was thinking, you know, we're told that the Jewish star was it was somehow a terrible thing. And it was basically the Jewish colours. They're encouraged to be proud of their identity, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's looking at it in a different way. And it was the SS that wanted the Jews to be proud of being Jewish and to understand that they were Jews first. And this idea that they could be culturally German and ethnically Jewish, they needed to be both culturally and ethnically Jewish. And they could have their own homeland where they could just be around other Jews. You can see that the nationalist way of doing things and how that was the same way of doing things that the Zionists wanted it. So it was a natural allies, basically.
Yeah, there's very little nationalistic about today, apart from maybe Zionists. But any other national thought is usually condemned in today's world.
It was under such auspices that the SS and Gestapo conducted all supportive and protective measures involving Jewish institutions. As strange as it may sound, it was to the Gestapo to which many Jews turned whenever a German bureaucracy disadvantaged them, or if they needed some other form of help. For example, when during the so-called Kristallnacht in November 1938, the Jewish emigration centre on Berlin's Meinecksstrasse was damaged, it was the SS that sent a team to clean up and to ensure that the office would be functioning again as soon as possible. And again, I've pointed this out before, the fact that they had this Jewish star, that was to alert the Gestapo that if anyone with a Jewish star was in trouble, they had to go and help them straight away. They took priority. If you were Jewish, it took priority that you needed to be helped. And that was one of the reasons why they had that Jewish star. And the SS...
wouldn't mainstream have an heart attack if that was well known.
Yeah. But it's all there in the histories. Leopold Edler von Mildenstein, who later headed the Jewish section of the SS... published a kind of propaganda tract for migration to Palestine as early as 1934. In that year, Mildenstein travelled to Palestine and remained there for half a year. His travelogue, titled Ein Nazifahrt nach Palästina, A Nazi Travels to Palestine, was serialised in Goebbels' magazine Der Angriff, September 26th to October 9th, 1934. The report is lively, vividly written, and offers an interesting picture of conditions in the British Mandate and of the political currents that prevailed in Palestine in the early 1930s. It is still quite readable today. Mildenstein used the pseudonym Lim, the first three letters of his name, read from right to left, as in Hebrew. And I think that might have been the origin of that medal that we were discussing last week, Dennis.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, yeah. And it's just the word Nazi and why that was used, which was always confusing me.
Ah, there we go. That's what he entitled it. And they're saying he headed the Jewish section of the SS. Maybe he was a Mischling, because there were Mischlings in the SS. And also this character, this Leopold Edler von Mildenstein, maybe we'll do a bit more about him next week, because just before we went on air, I discovered some information on him, and he looks quite interesting. I think later on he identified himself as working for the CIA, which adds more intrigue into this. And also it's talking about the Jewish section of the SS, and I was wondering, was that a Jewish unit? And I think it was just the section of the SS that worked with the Jews and worked with the Zionists rather than an actual formation of Jewish SS. The Waffen-SS was like the French Foreign Legion. Anybody could join it, and there were all these different groups of the Waffen-SS, but I don't think there was ever a Jewish Waffen-SS. And in Finland, the Jews fought alongside the Waffen-SS against the Soviet Union, and there's quite a bit about that online, but I don't think there was an actual Jewish Waffen-SS, although there are sort of myths about it, because that confused me a bit when it said he headed the Jewish section. And I think it must have just been the Jewish liaison. That was the part of the SS that worked with the Zionists and helped them out, basically. And if they had administrative problems, it would be the SS that said, leave these guys alone. They're good. They're nationalists. They're the same as us.
Yeah, the problem is that over the years there's been so many films made, about this, about the Jews being tormented and kicked out without the shirts on the back, that it's very difficult for people to believe what you're actually reading.
And so much of it just doesn't make sense, though, does it?
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know, if you wanted to have an ethno state, a pure ethno state, you wanted your country just to have your particular ethnicity within it, then you would do all that you can to help. If there was another ethnicity there, you would do all that you can to help that other ethnicity to go where it wanted to go, wouldn't you? It wouldn't matter where they wanted to go, but you would help them.
Especially peacefully.
Yeah. Yeah, so you didn't have these problems. The biggest problem was with Jews that wanted to be German, because you had a lot of mischlings. You had quarter Jews and you had half Jews, and three quarter Germans. And what would happen was they would be trying to show that they were that the German part was the stronger part. The German half was the stronger half, so they would want to fight in the SS, and they would want to fight in the Wehrmacht, and a lot of them were brilliant. They were really good. They won lots of awards because they were really trying to prove themselves and say, look, part of me is German, and that's the stronger part, and I can be just as brave and valiant as the Germans. And
of course, these Jews would have been against communism.
Yeah, and totally against communism. But then the problem you had was that they were still part Jewish. So if they'd married a German, it would have meant that family would have been Mischlings. They would have been part Jews as well. But they were loyal to Germany. But really, what the Germans wanted was them to identify with their Jewish part and help the other Jews build their homeland in Israel so that they could have their own ethnostate. That was really the issue. The SS and the Gestapo participated in establishing and financing the retraining camps, which in the meantime had been established by Zionist organisations all over Germany. And I'll just stop there because, you know, they could say, well, the SS were setting that up and it was retraining. They were forcing Jews to do things they didn't want to do. But this makes it clear that these organisations, these camps, had already been set up by Zionist organisations, these retraining camps. And then what happened was the SS and the Gestapo helped the Zionist organisations out. They financed these camps and helped with the training. So it wasn't similar to what happened in Britain when you say you get Edward I and he said, well, we're going to ban usury and you're going to have to learn to do something else. And he set up retraining for them, and they tried to train the Jews to do farming and blacksmithing and all these other things, but they were saying, and you can't do usury. And that's not what's going on here. They're not saying to the Jews, you have to go to these camps and retrain. They're just saying, we will help put these camps up there for the Jews that want to retrain. And it was set up by the Jews themselves originally, but then the SS and the Gestapo helped out. And in these camps, young Jews were to learn agricultural and trade professions to prepare them for the completely different life of Palestine. So again, that you know, you have to have admiration for them because they're learning a completely different skills, how to build a country. And it would have been the very best of them that went out there. Do you got any thoughts on that, Dennis?
Well, yeah, one thought is sadness for Germany, because the tries they might to do right, they've been forever cast as evil. And I even watched one program once when it was kind of a dating program, and this German guy was a millionaire, and the girl who went with him didn't actually know he was German, and even though he was a millionaire, as soon as she found out he was German, didn't want to know him.
Tragic. It's had so many negative effects, this war, and the telling of lies as well. The lies that are involved have messed so many people's lives up. The Jews as well have been messed up with the lies that they're told about what went on in the war, I think.
I mean, the guilt what the Germans have carried around for so long is has always been, in my eyes, a war crime, even though it was after the war.
You won't have been blamed for something they didn't do.
Exactly, yeah.
You blame for something they didn't do. But another side of it is, well, people will try and blame the Jews. And it wasn't the Jews that were the judges at Nuremberg. It was the Soviet Union, America, and Britain. They were the ones responsible for solidifying the lies about the war into the Nuremberg trial final agreement, what their decision was. That wasn't the Jews. The Jews may have come up with falsified statements, but the British, the Soviet, and the American judges didn't have to accept them. You know, that's a point I think we should make, because people do try and blame the Jews for all of it, and it's not just down to the Jews. They're going to do what is going to be best for them, aren't they? The problem is, we as white people did not do what is best for us. That's the issue.
No, well, even though, you know, some of the Jews in the camps obviously lied, so too did the American soldiers, because it was found out not long after that there was no gassings in any of the Western camps, and yet the American soldiers said there was.
And we went along with the Soviets, who we knew lied, who we knew had killed, you know, all those Polish officers at Kachin. And we went along with their lies that they found gas chambers in the camps. And none were found in the West. It was just the Soviets that said that. And we backed them up. That's the issue. We backed them up. In part, the SS even provided the land on which such camps could be established. Nicosia reproduces a map from August 1936 on which are marked 40 such establishments all across the Reich, from the furthest north, Flensburg and Gut-Lobitten, Königsberg, East Prussia, to Gut-Winkelhof in the south near the Swiss border. Such retraining camps were established even in Austria, the former Ostmark, after its annexation. Adolf Eichmann, the director of the Vienna Hauptamt für Jüdische Auswanderung, the main office for Jewish emigration, actively supported this program, and later, in concert with the Mossad, he vigorously supported illegal Jewish emigration. Occasionally, SS units even escorted Jewish emigration groups across the border and ensured that they crossed unhindered. Hannah Arendt was of the opinion that Eichmann's comment before the Jerusalem Tribunal in 1960 that he had saved hundreds of thousands of Jewish lives by such measures was factual, even though it was met with scornful laughter in court. Interesting. And a mention of the Mossad there, because as we'll hear, this is when the Mossad actually started, and it was working in unison with the Germans, incredibly enough.
Mm.
But think about that. The SS units were even going against the law once the emigration had stopped, and they were not allowed to keep legally helping the Jews to emigrate to Palestine. They were still helping them to do it illegally and helping them across the border. They weren't rounding them up, putting them on trains and putting them into these camps. They would much rather have helped them to get across the border and go where they're going. Apparently.
A strange one, really, because after the war, just as the war was ending, there was obviously there was people wanted in Germany who could speak the German language, and many Jews in America went back to Germany from where they first left and took all the prior positions again. Even Patton saw that the Germans were getting kicked out of the jobs. And these Jews for the return were taking over.
And how did they get there? We'll hear about that in a bit as well, because there was this second agreement that they had as well, which was for getting Jews out to other parts of the world. I mean, this bit we're talking about now is just the Jews that were making their way to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's just have a look at what some of these Jews that actually fought for Germany were like, because I managed to get some information on this. I thought we could look at that for a bit as well. A large number of Mischlings actually rose to high rank. 2 field marshals, 15 generals, 2 full generals, 8 lieutenant generals, and 5 major generals. Some Mischlings were Nazi party members. I would say National Socialist Party members. Obviously, this is coming from anti-national socialist literature, because it's very hard to find anything that's, you know, unbiased, basically. Some Mischlings were NSDP party members. 4 were full Jews, 15 were half Jews, and 7 were quarter Jews. Of the estimated 150,000 Mischlings, half Jews and quarter Jews, in the National Socialist armies, most never rose to officer levels, but many did fight valiantly and were decorated with medals for doing so. This is because they naturally wished to show they could be just as loyal and brave as a German, and to show that the German part of them had more influence than the Jewish part. Some were honoured by being made into honorary Aryans, and others were able to show their parentage was actually Aryan and not German. And there were some famous cases of this where a mother would make a sworn affidavit that actually the Jewish father was not the father of the child. And then the child would have a paperwork that would say that he was actually Aryan. Because a lot of these Mischlings, they would much rather have been born as Aryans, as Germans, rather than born as Jews. And you had others that would much rather have been would much rather be Jewish than German, but the Jews themselves wouldn't really accept them because it was their father that was Jewish and not the mother. And the Jewish religious thing says that to be a proper Jew, you only have to have a Jewish mother. But if you've got a Jewish father and you've got a German mother, then according to the German law, you were part Jewish, but according to the Jewish law, you were German. So, you know, must have been very awkward for those children. It's always awkward with mixing of the races because you're denying the child its heritage and its identity.
Yeah, you've got to remember the problems that Germany had after World War One, when the communists, who Germans looked on as, you know, Judaism, tried to take the country over. So you've got all that background as well.
And that's the political side of it, isn't it? You've got a lot of Jews that were supportive of communism. Now, as we pointed out in the first episode, it was only a small portion of the Jews that were Zionists at first. But then with the National Socialists' help to promote the Zionist ideas and the Jewish identity, the Zionist groups became the largest group. And I think near the end, the Zionists were the largest group in Germany, rather than the communist sympathising Jews. And I guess they continued increasing, really. Which would you say is the more predominant group today, Dennis, Zionist or communist?
Difficult one, really. I suppose if I had to guess, it would be Zionist, but I think communism, which never actually went anywhere, has recently has risen a bit. So it's difficult to say.
They do seem to have loyalty to Israel, don't they? And with their redefinition of anti-Semitism as sort of being criticism of Israel, that is a Zionist thing, isn't it? It's support of Israel. And I think basically what they're saying is everybody has to support Israel. Everybody has to be a Zionist, even if they are a communist.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's some of the more Orthodox Jews who are against Israel, as far as I know.
So it's funny, isn't it? Zionism started as the smallest group, the smallest number of people, but I guess they had a lot of influence with the bankers and the rest of it, and then they gradually grew to be the biggest group. But at the time when you had the Bolshevik Revolution happening, it was communism that was the largest group, the biggest organisation.
Yeah, that's fair, yeah. Well, and obviously once they attained Israel, nationalism would have grown, because previous to that, not having their own country, like, it would have been difficult for someone to say that they were ever going to have one. So certainly made a big difference once they got Israel, I would imagine.
Yeah, and it was under the British mandate for so long. I think it was a couple of years after the war, Britain said, look, we just had enough of this. It's just causing so much problems with the Arabs and the Jews and us having to manage it. We're just going to give up on this. We gave it to the UN and said, look, the UN's going to have to sort this out.
Communist organisation. No, what puzzles me is that I can remember watching a programme once when they were saying that there was no problem at all between Arabs and the Jews. In fact, each would babysit for each other at one point. But I couldn't tell you just when that was.
Well, I think looking back at the history of it, the Jews always had this idea that they would have a specific part of the land. And what they wanted to do was to encourage the Arabs that were already there to move to another specific part of the land. And I'm sure they probably would have used their funds to try and help the Arabs to move to that other part of the land. But the Arabs themselves were not happy about what was going on. And there was a lot of fighting and there was a lot of Arab uprisings and there was a lot of violence. And the British ended up having to put down one massive Arab uprising quite brutally. Mm-hmm. Apparently. And I think that was really where it started with all the violence, because you would think, well, you've got Jews, a lot of Jews are bankers, they're going to have a lot of wealth and funds. You know, they could have paid these Palestinian Arabs to move to somewhere else. But the Palestinian Arabs were quite militaristic, weren't they? I mean, they had that 1967 war as well.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that what people forget is obviously that Palestine declared holy war when they joined Germany in World War II. And so I don't think they've ever been forgiven for that one. Likewise, Israel's always got a beef with Iran, because Iran is the land of Aryans. So there's always going to be some kind of conflict between them two.
Yeah, good points there. The Mufti does come into this Palestinian Mufti that was with... Well, he was in Berlin for a while, wasn't he? He was like a refugee in Berlin, and there was a Palestinian SS unit, Waffen SS unit,
in the Balkans,
and that does get mentioned in the official histories. So I guess what they're trying to do is smear the Palestinians there. So they'll smear the Palestinian Arabs for working with the National Socialists, but there's no mention of the Jews working with the National Socialists. No mention at all of. This Zionist agreement that they had between them. As I said, the Mossad got mentioned earlier. I think we'll get back onto them later. Next, we have the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement. The Havarah Agreement specifically dealt with migration to Palestine, but the second state-regulated process was the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement, which concerned itself with immigration to other countries, which was the goal of the majority of the emigrating Jews. Just as did Palestine, other countries also required proof of the immigrants' financial independence, which caused considerable problems for Germany. The German Reichsbank was forced to provide large amounts of already scarce foreign currency for this emigration, and many countries refused to accept Jewish immigrants as well. So this really explains the problem there, doesn't it? Because you've got this foreign currency embargo that is on Germany, when these Jews want to move out and they say, look, we'll give you the money to the bank has got a problem with actually being able to change that up for the foreign currency that they're going to need to provide at the border of the country that they're going to. So at least with Palestine, that's why they had all this complicated agreement, so that they didn't need to find the foreign currency.
Well, you've got to look at why they declared war on Germany, the Jews, outside of Germany. And what happened was Hitler came to power in 1933, and obviously with all that had gone on previously with the communists, he put the communists in camps, and most of the communists at that time obviously were Jews. And so with the Jews outside, especially the ones in America, who were complaining about the treatment of these Jews in the camps, which, in actual fact, as in communism by the back door, assure that the Americans went over there to investigate the camps and there was nothing wrong with them. And so this myth is continued again to build up the evil National Socialists and evil Nazis, if you like. And all the time, they were defending the outside of Germany, the Jews outside were defending the imprisonment of communists.
Yeah, that gets reported on as they were just jailing them because they were Jews, and that wasn't
so. That's right.
That was the narrative that was going on outside of Germany. All these people are being jailed in the camps just because they were Jewish, and it wasn't. It was because because they were communist. If you've got the SS that are helping the Zionist organizations, providing the land for them, providing the finance for them, going on, then they can't be saying that the people that are in the camps are going in there just because they're Jewish. They were put in there because they were communist. If they were Zionist, nationalist, proud to be Jewish, because don't forget the communists were saying, get rid of all religion. And what today's Jews will say is they will say that the large number of Jews that were involved in communism, they weren't really Jews because they weren't religious Jews. They had rejected religion. They were atheists, and communism was atheist. So they were still Jewish ethnically, but they had rejected the Jewish religion. So they will claim that they aren't actually Jewish today. And what they're saying is the ones that were put in these camps were put in there because they were communist. Not because they were Jewish.
Exactly.
Getting back to...
I'll have to find out the name of the guy who came over from America to investigate the camps, because he obviously found nothing wrong with them.
Yeah, that would be a good one to learn a little bit more about. Well, this topic, the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement, this topic was addressed at the International Refugee Conference in the summer of 1938 at the French health resort Evian-les-Bains at Lake Geneva. Representatives from 32 countries met there at the Hotel Royal from July the 6th to the 15th to discuss how German Jews could be helped. All the conference participants were united. They condemned the prevailing anti-Semitism in Germany. They were most empathetic towards the poor Jews who had been expelled from their homes. They agreed with resolutions that places must be found where the Jews could be accommodated. But every single speaker emphasised that unfortunately his country was not in a position to help by taking in a larger number of immigrants. So this was the situation. The other countries didn't want to accept any of them, and Britain was saying, we're going to limit the number that you can send to Palestine to, it was either 15,000 a year or 150,000 a year. So it was only a small number.
Well, there must be a reason behind it. Probably the Germans to look good, I don't know.
Yeah, criticising Germany for how it was dealing with this group of people that had basically been declared enemies of the state by the Jews on the outside. How are they supposed to deal with them apart from putting them in camps, which is the same way that same thing that Britain did? It put the Germans in camps, and the same thing that America did,
it put the Japanese
in camps. So the Germans have got the people in camps, the communist types, the seditious types, the terrorist types. And then you've got the rest of the world saying they're all in there just because they're Jews. And Germany is saying, well, why don't you take them then? Why don't you take them? We'll fund this. We will help this. Mm. We will sort this out for you.
Well, because they didn't want communists, did they?
No. The only result to come out of the conference was the establishment of an intergovernmental committee based in London. Its president was a lawyer from New York, George Rubley. From the outset, Rubley tried to establish contact with the German government. This endeavour, which was supported by the German ambassador in London, Herbert von Dirksen, and the director of the political section of the Foreign Ministry, Ernst Wermann, was successfully sabotaged for months on end by the state secretary in the Foreign Ministry, Ernst von Weizsäcker, the father of post-war German president Richard von Weizsäcker. Weizsäcker let Rubley be advised that he should not hope for any kind of cooperation from the German side, and he repeatedly rejected any attempts from other diplomats to put Rubley in contact with the German authorities. He even forbade the German embassy in London to respond in any way to Rubley's attempts to make contact, or so much as even mention them in Berlin. He inquired of the British Chargé d'Affaires in Berlin whether Rubley was Aryan. When Rubley wanted to travel to Berlin of his own accord, Weizsäcker bluntly rejected his request because to his mind it was of no value. And that is a real shame, isn't it? I mean, he's really just sabotaging things there by preventing Rubley from getting to talk to who he needs to talk to. Well, finally, Hitler learned of Weizsäcker's unauthorised conduct and immediately summoned Reichsbank President von Schacht to his office. He authorised Schacht to work out a financial plan that would enable Germany's remaining Jews to emigrate. Schacht developed a proposal, and in mid-December 1938, Hitler dispatched him to London for a discussion with Rubley and other individuals. After the war, Schacht described this so as to suggest that the plan and the trip to England had been his idea, which he had had to convince Hitler to adopt, but contemporary documents prove otherwise. After his return from London, an article written on his initiative appeared in the Berliner Zeitung of December 19th, 1938. Schacht discussion in London, the purpose of the trip. The Foreign Ministry was annoyed at this, and Weizsäcker was given the task of getting an explanation from Schacht. This occurred in a telephone conversation on December 20th, 1938, about which Weizsäcker wrote a memo. It states that Weizsäcker had asked Schacht whether he had received an order from the Führer and whether he, Schacht, had initiated the newspaper report. President Schacht unhesitatingly admitted that the article came from him. It concerned a command from the Führer, which he, the President, had executed within the prescribed framework in London. The Führer requests a report after the return. He, Schacht, has now made an appointment to report to the Führer within the next 2 days, and then will also call upon the Reich Minister Ribbentrop to give a report. He will not comment further on the matter until he has reported to the Führer. So that shows that it was Hitler's idea, and he was working on Hitler's instruction and had to report back to him. It wasn't Schacht's idea.
Yeah. The truth will out, as I say.
Again, because this runs counter to the narrative, doesn't it? Because what they're saying there is that Hitler wanted to sort it out so that all Germany's remaining Jews could emigrate. Financial plan to enable that.
And, yeah, well, Schacht was a former Freemason, so you can't expect anything else from him.
And you think of the money that was going to cost as well to do this.
Mm.
A financial plan. You know, they're willing to put money into this idea, oh, we'll just kill them all, we'll just gas them all. It doesn't make any sense.
Never did make sense.
Schacht's later recall of his activities at this stage of his career was obviously influenced by subsequent historical events. His version and what the documents reveal are quite different. In any case, in 1938, the Schacht plan was adopted by the Intergovernmental Committee as a basis for discussion. And in January 1939, Rubley was invited to Berlin independently of the Foreign Ministry. There he discussed matters first with Schacht, then with Goering's ministerial director, Helmut Wohlfahrt. Within 4 weeks, the Rubley-Wohlfahrt agreement had been reached. And I guess we should stop there, and we'll get into the agreement next week, because we're sort of nearing the end here. Got any thoughts on what we've been discussing today, Dennis?
It just kind of cements that this myth of Germans hating Jews is what it was, a myth.
Well, it really shows that, you know, that they weren't fleeing. They weren't running away and having all their possessions being taken from them, stolen from them. There was a lot of work that had been put in place to ensure that they could take their possessions with them. There was a lot of work that was put in place to ensure that the place that they were moving to, Palestine, was fit for modern people to live in, because at the time the Palestinians were riding around on camels with wagons behind them, and it wasn't industrial.
I think it was different to the Berlin Jews who left. They were annoyed at the fact that they were more or less leaving on their own free will, because they knew what they were doing in Berlin was no longer going to be sustained once Hitler came to power. But this is a totally different angle. This is Germans helping the Jews to leave the country. People like who went to America, like I said, were bitter, and it proved that when they came back to Germany after the war.
I think that's a really good point that you make. I mean, the ones that went to America were like the Frankfurt school Jews, the Hollywood Jews, the rich capitalists that had made a killing in the Weimar period, and the ones that were left there in Germany that were going to Palestine were doctors, workers, agriculturalists.
Different type altogether.
And they actually succeeded pretty quickly, making Palestine, their part of Palestine, had the best medical facilities in the whole area. And they really did improve very, very quickly, because it was very backwards up until that point. As I say, you have Palestinians riding around on camels with old wagons, and then you had these Jews that were coming in there with German technology, German engineering.
Wealth. Yeah.
With the Jewish wealth and building a country and building a fit country for modern people to live in. It's a really fascinating story, actually. I'm finding this. I'm learning a lot out myself, and I guess you're probably learning a lot of new things as well. And listeners are really going to learn a lot in the next episode. And when we get to the bits with the Mossad and the Irgun as well, it's a totally different history to the one that we've been taught, but we'll get into some more next week then, Dennis. So thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.